such a debacle, it's hard to say where panic set in. It was such an ill-conceived and misbegotten adventure. I was not mature in the way I should have been at that point. I was in my late 20s. I suppose I had to go and experience that disaster in order to become the person I am now.
Legendary filmmaker Todd Solondz. He's just one of the many fascinating people we heard from this year. Much more to come today on The Cinema Show. Also ahead.
It's this film that is set in this kind of contemporary LA fashion scene and made as if it is a kind of like one long extended fashion shoot.
Editor of Little White Lies magazine, David Jenkins, will join me to look at the year's best and worst films. And a little later.
Without ever finding the right words, and because you are uncomfortable in your skin, and you are nervous and insecure, and everything you say is actually bullshit, and all you're trying to say is I love you, but you are too proud to say that.
A word from filmmaker Xavier Dolan, high-rise director Ben Wheatley, and Palme d'Or winner Ken Loach, plus a special tribute to Carrie Fisher and Debbie Reynolds on this end-of-year edition of The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Ryland, coming to you from Studio One at Midori House here in London on the very last Friday of 2016. And I'm joined today by The Cinema Show's very good friend and editor of the world's most beautiful movie magazine, Little White Lies. David Jenkins, welcome back to the program. Lots of people tend to have their own lists of these best films, but perhaps it makes more sense in your case to count down our favourite covers of Little White Lies from throughout the year. Where would you begin?
I guess one of my favourite covers was for the film The Neon Demon, which I think when that film came out, it wasn't a film that was everyone's cup of tea, to be honest.
No, but it did have, I mean, it's funny you should mention the cover because I remember that cover specifically, but I also remember this amazing advertising campaign that the film had in the Tube here in London. It seemed to be one of those films that really lent itself very, very well to visual expression, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's one of those, it's this film that is, set in this kind of contemporary LA fashion scene and made as if it is a kind of like one long extended fashion shoot. And as such, it's one of those films that you could take any frame from it, or it was a very gif-able film, to use the modern parlance, I guess. You take any individual element of it, it's something you could use on social media or as a way to sort of entice people in. But I think maybe when all those gifts were put together, people were maybe a little bit less interested. I think it was a real gift when it came to sort of looking at it creatively and expanding on it in magazine form through illustration and writing, and it was kind of super successful for us.
I see 20 or 30 girls come in here every day from small towns with big dreams. Some girls crack under the pressure. You're going to be great.
All right, so let's talk about some of the other covers of the year then. So we've talked about The Neon Demon. What were some of the other covers that really stood out for you?
Another one that I really enjoyed doing, and again, I mean, this going back to sort of the commercial side of a film, I mean, this wasn't really a sort of assumption when we did a cover on the film or the trilogy Arabian Nights back in January and February of this year. This was a Portuguese film that sort of ran 4 hours in three parts, and it was this kind of phantasmagoric, very, very idiosyncratic take on the kind of the 1001 Nights by the Portuguese director Miguel Gomez. I mean, he's just someone whose films, he'd made a couple of films before and lots of great shorts. I just really love this guy. I think in terms of a kind of creative vision, I would hope that there'd be a certain sort of synchronicity there in terms of like willingness to sort of look at material from a slightly different angle.
It's quite audacious, isn't it? The way he came at that source material. I remember he came in here to talk to us on the cinema show, and I asked him about how he ever even approached such a topic from that perspective.
I mean, relatively speaking, I think I'm guessing the team making it were relatively small themselves, so relatively it was probably quite a big undertaking for them to do.
For them, of course,
and,
yes.
And with budgets that were probably very tiny. Yeah, I mean, I don't think that Miguel Gomez made that film with a view to kind of protecting the budget and making sure that, you know, it was, you know, every penny was going to come back and, you know, we're putting this scene in so we can make some big profit. And I mean, yeah, I mean, it's totally, I guess you call it the sort of old-fashioned term is that auteur-driven cinema where it's, you know, it's a mind that is just being allowed to sort of, you know, unfettered access to creativity. And it's just a director sort of really following instincts rather than templates, I guess.
Mas por acaso vos contasse uma história que causasse espanto, poderiam vir a refugar a vossa sentença?
When the trailers first started popping out for a film like Arrival, I was quite relieved that we were starting to see some larger Hollywood blockbuster-style films that weren't coming in the mould of the superhero epic and so on. What were some of the bigger movie releases of this year that really stuck out for you?
Well, I mean, it might be worth saying that, like, from my perspective, this was an epically bad year for blockbuster releases. I mean, I probably couldn't name a single one. I mean, I would say actually Rogue One is probably like far and away the best studio release I saw this year, which is maybe a bit of a downer. But you know, everything I felt this year from the studios, it just felt really schematic and dull, and it just seemed with every screening I was attending of whatever the next big film was, just came with a certain, I wouldn't say crushing disappointment, but just a case of
a
like
a bit of a thud.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this used to be the Dream Factory. This used to be
exactly.
Like,
yeah.
You know, these guys, these were like super skilled guys who you kind of didn't mind tapping into these things that you know, just this idea of like pure, pure pleasure, I guess, you know, like, and they just didn't deliver. It was whether it was like it was too dark or certain take on material or the terrible sense of humour or just felt like it was the same story told over again.
It feels as though the larger Hollywood studios aren't really in... They're just not in line with the culture at the moment. It feels like maybe there's been a bit too much emphasis on the otherworldly sorts of films, the ones that are taken from the pages of comic books and so on.
I know this is meant to be a celebration of the best, but I think I couldn't go without mentioning how much I despised Batman versus Superman: Dawn of Justice.
I could not agree with you more.
As the nadir of the year's Hollywood filmmaking. As the cliche goes, it was everything that was wrong about filmmaking in 2016.
For that film to basically collate all of those things into one long, way, way, way too long epic film, I think that was a lot for many, many people to swallow. So which films will we remember as 2016's finest? David's pick was the nostalgic comedy by Richard Linklater, Everybody Wants Some, set around a group of college baseball players in the 1980s. For me, well, Tom Ford's Nocturnal Animals is still floating around in my brain, as is Andrea Arnold's American Honey, which was my pick of the bunch at Cannes this year too. And I must add that not all the big Hollywood offerings were so bad this year. I thought Disney's remake of The Jungle Book was such fun. A great reminder of why some movies are still best enjoyed on the big screen. My thanks to David Jenkins from Little White Lies magazine. Now, the Canadian filmmaker Xavier Dolan achieved the kind of feat in 2009 that few filmmakers have mastered. At just 20 years old, his debut feature, I Killed My Mother, made it into the director's fortnight. It picked up 3 awards at the festival and even attracted a standing ovation from the notoriously prickly festival crowd. His latest film, It's Only the End of the World, follows a young man returning home to his family after a long absence, ostensibly to announce his pending death due to an unmentioned illness. Of all the interviews we featured throughout the year, Xavier was certainly one of the most fascinating. he's not always been the best of friends with critics and journalists. And though he's actually perfectly charming, his intolerance for silly, fluffy questions is certainly no secret.
There are not a lot of bridges to be built between that world, that story, and mine. This is not the relationship that I have with my family, either my father's family or my mom's family. It's just, or family at all. I don't have a tormented relationship to family. I did have a complicated, let's call it complicated, relationship with my mom. I don't have a simple relationship with my dad, but I do have amazing cousins, aunts, uncles. I love family. I go to my family and we have dinner and we play games. We play cards. I've lived at my uncle's and aunt's, at my cousin's house when I was in high school. Lived there for 3 years. And they were, I think, the best years of my life, at least the ones I am most nostalgic of.
That seems to strike quite a contrast from the kind of dramatic situations that arise in many of your films. Does that kind of tense drama still ring true for you personally?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I haven't lived that with my family. Doesn't mean I haven't lived that with other human beings, other friends, or it's not exclusive to family to have, you know, the family events to have no resolution, or to family members to not listen to each other. There is a lot of people out there who are not listening to you, and you are not listening to a whole bunch of people too. So that's just life. We work on our capacity or incapacity to listen and love and talk, and communicating is everything. And there are people we can communicate with. But when I read the play, I was very drawn to these characters and very impressed by their brutality and their violence, how aggressive they were, and inconsiderate, and yet very sensitive. And I mean, I guess how all the contradictions and contrasts in what they say versus what they feel and where they look and what they do, does it still feel true to life? Probably someone else's life, not just not mine. I don't see why that type of resolution wouldn't feel true to life. Life is often unexplained and unjustified. We don't have reasons for everything and answers to all questions.
Some people seem to take issue with the film not revealing everything about the characters and the situations that they're in. It's almost as if you're asking the audience to step inside the house with the characters and experience the drama as they are, with all the unspoken thoughts and, all the second-guessing.
I know that people were frustrated to not know why the lead character had actually gone, why he had left home years ago without ever coming back. I know they are frustrated that I never said whether he was dying of AIDS or cancer or what it was exactly he was dying from. Does it really matter? I think that what matters is what these people have to say to one another within that given amount of time. The time that they have together, which is, 5 or 6 hours tops. So that's what the film is about, how you use the time you have with the people that are in front of you and how you come clean with them, how you try to be true to yourself, but without ever finding the right words, and because you are uncomfortable in your skin and you are nervous and insecure and everything you say is actually bullshit and all you're trying to say is I love you, but you are too proud to say that. So you spend an infinite amount of time just rehashing the same words and just spend so much time on that sort of, you know, mindless chatter and small talk and avoid saying the essential about how you feel towards a person, whether you love that person or not.
Xavier Dolan's new film, It's Only the End of the World, will be released in the United Kingdom on February the 27th. I, Daniel Blake, is Ken Loach's enormously powerful indictment of Britain's welfare system, though it could easily translate to many other parts of the world as well. It was the somewhat surprising winner of the Palme d'Or at Cannes this year, a second for Ken Loach and his screenwriter Paul Laverty after 2006's The Wind That Shakes the Barley.
Paul wrote two characters who have quite simple, straightforward situations. And we felt that if we just told those two stories, and particularly Daniel's story, it would say or imply everything we wanted to say about the situation.
The film's strength undoubtedly comes from its brutally honest depiction of the misery and hope that underpins the welfare system. And despite all that research, I wondered whether there was a particular moment that made Ken feel as though he'd really found the truth of the matter.
Well, it's a process. I mean, you just never know. It's dozens of little decisions all the time, finding the right people, and we were really lucky found two. Well, the whole group was authentic and talented and brought the story together. I mean, just simple, like the man in the scene at the end when Daniel goes for his assessment, a man called Mike Laffey, who in real life does that work, advises clients in claims about Social Security, just brought his own authenticity. You know, the depth of what he knew just somehow is present in the scene, even though he's only got a few lines.
As we were chatting in our comfortable hotel room overlooking London Soho, I thought about the emotional punch that the film inflicts and wondered how it might be received by those living their lives in conditions perhaps a little closer to those depicted in the film. As Ken explains, he's been sure that there are plenty of screening opportunities, and so far, the reception has been positive.
Yes, Unite the Union have been very helpful in putting on a lot of screenings for and inviting people who are close to the situation. Mm. And we've had an extraordinary response. People saying they are experiencing this on a daily basis, just saying the film's okay, really, and that's a huge boost to us, because to give a voice to people who are generally not heard is really important.
Ken Loach, director of this year's Palme d'Or winner at Cannes, I, Daniel Blake. This is The Cinema Show. Still to come, high-rise director Ben Wheatley and legendary independent filmmaker Todd Solondz. Stay with us.
Do you like bad movies? No, neither do we. But don't worry, we've discovered a cure for bad films. It's called MUBI.
Sometimes Wells' films aren't very nourishing. They're very exciting. Citizen Kane, I think, absolutely wins the competition for the film that has made more people want to become a filmmaker than any other.
Every day, MUBI adds a new must-see film to its carefully curated selection. No junk-filled mess or endless scrolling. Just an assembly of the best movies from all over the world waiting to be devoured. To sample a whole month of movies for free, just head over to MUBI.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. Hurry now, the film's about to start.
This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. High Rise is a seedy spectacle that takes us inside the bizarre world of a 1970s brutalist apartment building. The film is, of course, based on the J.G. Ballard novel from 1975, which imagines how the perfect modern skyscraper, thoughtfully designed to cater to every human need, unwittingly awakens an uncontrollable desperation for chaos. We were at the Picturehouse Central Cinema here in London for a special Q&A with the director Ben Wheatley and the Picturehouse's Paul Ridd.
Would you like to start by telling us a little bit about the genesis of this project? Obviously, you've made four films prior to High Rise, and each in a different register, a different genre and different scale. This feels like the biggest film you've made to date in terms of the scale, the cast, the sort of ambition of it. Where did it begin?
I came into it through the film had been they'd been trying to make the film for a long time. I think the film had been optioned in like 76. It was the original, the book was written in 75. Yeah, and so it'd been around for a long time, and they'd been trying to get it made, and I had no idea about any of this. So I basically came to it kind of a year or so before production, and just was sitting at home and thought, well, you know, I saw it on my shelf, and I thought, why hasn't it been made? And it was a particular favourite book of mine when I was a kid. And I'd kind of gone dipped in and out of Ballard, you know, subsequently. But when I went back and reread it, it felt like it was incredibly prescient. And that from what I'd read before, when I read it in the kind of late 80s, early 90s, it was quite close to when it had been written. And it felt like a kind of, it fitted in with that kind of predictive kind of dystopian fiction. But when I reread it, it felt like it had happened. And I think that was the moment I kind of thought, well, this would be really interesting to kind of make it as a movie. But obviously, just dipping into your own bookshelf and pulling books off the side and hoping to make them is quite random. And we never thought basically, how it usually works is you do that, and then you get a right search on it and try and find out if anyone's got it. And usually they have. You know, most novels have been bought up by Hollywood. I mean, they don't just even buy books, they buy authors, or they buy whole genres now, you know, and it's just a kind of total clearance of all kind of cultural products. So I didn't hold out much hope, you know, that it was available. But it was, and it was and it was being held by Jeremy Thomas, who produced Crash and Naked Lunch, amongst many, many other movies. And it all moved very quickly from there. You know, within 3 days of kind of re-looking at the book, I was talking to Jeremy, and that was the start of it.
High-rise director Ben Wheatley there with the Picture House's Paul Ridd. Todd Solondz made his first film way back in 1989, but he was so infuriated by the whole process that he swore never to make another picture. Well, thankfully, he was persuaded back to the craft by a friend who promised to co-finance his next project. That became 1995's Welcome to the Dollhouse, and it took the Grand Jury Prize at the Sundance Film Festival. 21 years later, Todd Solondz is back, and this time he's carrying a dachshund for his latest film, Wiener Dog.
You need to exercise.
I walk my dog.
Exercise.
I can't. You gotta have a what if.
What if you taught script writing at a film school and had no talent?
Wiener dog, wiener dog.
I think it's really great that you have a new dog. What's its name?
Well, I always wanted to make a dog movie, and I had thought about Bresson's Ozar Balthazar on one end of the spectrum and Benji on the other, and hoped that this could sit somewhere between the two. The dog, the dachshund in this case, is a kind of conceit. It is a presence throughout the film, but the film, really, which tells four different stories, is not about a dog per se. It is not the story of the trials and tribulations, the triumphs of a dog. Rather, it's a kind of prism it serves as to, through which one can explore, I can explore and play with a certain ideas and subjects, amongst which are mortality, which hovers and shadows each of these stories in different ways.
Were you playing somewhat off the concept of a dog having some sort of impact in people's lives, and that impact not necessarily being simple friendship and companionship?
I guess that's fair to say, but I'm not sure I would use the word protagonist. The dog is not so much a character. It's not very expressive the way humans are, yet the way in which the characters engage with or take advantage of or perceive the dog and gives new meaning to not just the dog, which is in some sense beside the point, even as it is the name of the movie, but rather serve as some mirror to the follies and flaws and fumblings of all of these characters.
Now, most of your films revolve around people that could be described as outsiders in various different contexts. Do you think the Wiener Dog is an outsider as well? Perhaps the ultimate outsider, because he literally can't understand what people are saying to him and can't communicate back.
That's fair. And certainly, you're particularly an outsider if you are neutered or spayed in some way. That does make you even more of an outsider, irreproducible outsider. And this is something that plays into the themes of the film.
When the film starts off, we have a young boy who really quite simplistically wants the dog to continue to be his friend, and that is forcibly not possible. Later in the film, we get to the point where we've got, well, probably two characters who, for whatever reason, the dog has come into their lives at a point where they're starting to question their existentialism, and that gets resolved, or perhaps is left unresolved in certain ways. Do you think that perhaps people, when animals come into their lives, they perhaps project what they're already feeling onto those animals in some way?
Well, yes, they are often anthropomorphized in ways that can be at the expense of the animal itself and can serve as mirrors or sources of consolation, function in different ways depending on the needs of the particular character.
A lot of your films seem to exist in a similar sort of universe. There is quite a specific world that could be described as the Todd Solondz world. Some people have speculated that maybe all of your films are actually connected in some way and that they're all taking place in this mythical make-believe world. Do you have anything to say to that?
Well, the films are a reflection of a sensibility, of my sensibility, of the way in which I experience and understand the world I live in. So to that extent, they all share that commonality. It's not like I can change my worldview or my perspective on the human experience from movie to movie. Perhaps it evolves in some ways. I'm not very self-analytical, but it is, I hope, distinctive enough that an audience can continue to experience the provocations, as mild as they may be, because certainly when I go to the movies, I like to be provoked and stimulated and to see the world in a way that articulates things in a way I haven't articulated them myself in my own life. That's one of the pleasures of movies, is the way it puts out there on film something of which we find we cannot speak of even amongst our intimates. Movies have a very mysterious kind of power in that way, and maybe that's how I fell in love with them.
Legendary independent filmmaker Todd Solondz. And that's it for this week and for 2016. Today's show was edited by Kieran Matthew Banerjee and researched by Yolene Goffin. Thanks to all of our listeners and subscribers, The Cinema Show will, of course, be back next week for another exploration of film culture. But, of course, we couldn't sail out of the year without paying tribute to two legends of the screen that we sadly lost over the Christmas period. To many of us, Carrie Fisher was synonymous with Princess Leia, the original iron-willed heroine of the Star Wars universe. But it was her wit and honesty that touched people most. The death of her mother just one day later came at the end of a year that just hasn't stopped surprising us. Debbie Reynolds was the kind of Hollywood star that doesn't exist anymore. Bright, optimistic, all singing and all dancing, she was a true legend, but she also cared very deeply for the town that made her name, perhaps more so than anyone else. Hollywood is a relentless machine that's never been very good at respecting its history. Debbie Reynolds was indeed the warrior it had to have. When the old MGM studios faded and historical artifacts were thrown away like yesterday's newspaper, she set about purchasing various props and costumes, from dresses worn by Judy Garland in Meet Me in St. Louis to Charlie Chaplin's famous bowler hat. Her collection included memorabilia recalling just about every major Hollywood star there ever was. Debbie Reynolds understood the power of the movies and the importance of their history, and Hollywood will forever be richer because of her. We'll leave you now with a song from the much-loved 1973 film Charlotte's Web, in which she provided the voice of the friendly spider. This is Debbie Reynolds with Mother Earth and Father Time. I'm Ben Rylan. Have a happy new year.
Mother Earth and Father.